Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuayhis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Hello everyone, this is Bluewater, and this is Prophecy Keepers Radio. I'd like to welcome everyone to the show. I'd like to introduce our special guest today. Is Chokosh Aho'o. She is a Chumash Indian elder of coastal California Indians. And how are you today, Chokosh?
Oh, very well. Thank you, Bluewater. Nice to talk to you.
It's a real treat to have you. And I guess we had a chat the other night and talked about lots of interesting things. And I thought I'd tell the folks how I found you, and we'll just kind of go from there.
I'd like to know myself.
Well, as you know, I publish a couple of prophecy encyclopedias, one for the Eastern and one for the Western Hemisphere. And from time to time, I do a web search, anything having to do with the Hopi elders. And I guess about a year and a half ago, ran across your name on the Internet. Because the elders, I guess, had called you back, I guess, about 10 years ago and had a couple of messages. The most impressive one to me was the 10 points that they gave you. And then the one that, I guess, Uncle John gave you, which... Yeah, the two of them together make a lot of sense. So, and I guess you knew what John Lanza and his wife. And why don't you go ahead and tell us about those experiences?
Oh, Why? I was not raised in the Indian tradition. My grandfather on my father's side was Chumash and some early California Spanish, and my grandmother German. And the Indian connection was not spoken of, although I was quite dark-skinned. And on my mother's side, her people came out of Mexico in 1922, and they were some Spanish and French and then Yaqui and Mayo Indian, all coastal peoples. And I had a feeling, and there were times when my grandmother on my mother's side would kind of make jokes, and at one point she put into my hands, when I was about 16, a blanket, which she said had all of the medicine and the journeys and what it was that her grandmother had learned. And she put it in my arms, but she didn't go into any detail. And they were of, as many other Indian people of my age now know, there were some generations there that were either too afraid to teach their grandchildren or their children Indian ways, or they were ashamed.
Uh-huh.
And, but I had this predilection, this tendency to live in the trees, to take my shoes off, to talk to the earth. And in 1965, I happened to join some Baha'is at a fireside in Tempe, Arizona, and there was a man speaking about the Apache people and about Geronimo, and he had people come up and look at these photographs, and I was so deeply moved. There was a photograph, a large photograph, of Geronimo up close, and his eyes simply glistened and burned, and it was like the whole history of the Indian people and all that they had gone through and their courage and the beauty that would survive no matter what was in his eyes. Well, it was, I probably have never had anything hit me so hard. I went outside just to be out of the room. Suddenly there was so much, seemed like so much noise that I just needed to get quiet. So I went out and I stood under the desert night stars and just began weeping. It was like feeling the waves of what had happened to the native peoples, what had been their experience. And it was, I just began crying. At first I thought it was for myself, and then it felt like it was for all the world and all the generations of all the people, because of the terrible ignorance that causes so much pain. When I came back into the building where Philip Cassador was speaking, he looked at me very directly the moment that I entered. And for the next half of the Baha'i fireside, he was speaking about his people. He never took his eyes off of me. And I felt my whole life at that moment shift. Afterwards, he came up to me and he said, "I want to take you to my people. I want you to meet my mother." And I think there was a short visit. It's kind of hard. That goes way back quite a ways. That would have been early 1966, I think. And I ended up, they made a dress for me, and I danced with the people there for 4 days and four nights and during the ceremony. And this was my first real experience with not in the movies Indian. And of course there's, it seems like, almost no connection. Shortly after that, and there's a whole story of what happened the 4 days that I was there, shortly after that, living near the beach, there was a community radio station there called KTFK in Los Angeles, part of the Pacifica radio. And a friend of mine had asked me if I had heard the 5 days of interviewing the Hopi elders, what was called a colloquium. And I said, no, I hadn't heard that. He said, well, you must make this connection. He had come all the way down to the beach to be sure that I knew this was happening. And he ended up taking me to a place in Hollywood where Thomas Banyankya and one of the Hopi elders, David Menantier, were speaking. And there was also a man there who was Chumash. He called himself Semu Huahute. As I sat there and I listened to the elders talk about how the government was attempting to regain, take away all the Hopi land by a terrible system of mortgages. It was a 27-page bill that was kind of being snuck and yet pushed through Congress, called the Omnibus Bill or Omnibus Act. So I don't think I spoke to the elders that night, but I went home and tried to write letters, tried to compose a story that could be published exposing this. And I realized that I was making a terrible mistake, that by my trying to help without personal knowledge of the people I was crusading for, that I might do them more harm than good.
Mm.
And with that, I took my two young children who were sleeping in their beds, put them in the back seat of the car, a bunch of laundry that I figured that I could wash somewhere along the way, and started heading out for some place called Hopi. And then I arrived in Flagstaff a day or so later and suddenly became terrified that what did I think I was doing? Who did I think I was? And would they ignore me or laugh at me? And suddenly I was facing the mystique of the native wisdom and my own inadequacies, and ended up staying 3 days and three nights in that motel room with my children, just not knowing whether to go forward or go back.
Mm.
And finally, I just decided it was worth the risk. And so as I then drove onto the Hopi Reservation, the Hopi Land, I won't call it a reservation, I pulled into a place, and I think that I, by that point, had known that it was Hot Villa, and I got the two elders, Thomas Banyankya and David Menantier. I got their names mixed up, and I drove up to a bunch of Hopi kids playing baseball out in the field, and I asked them where Thomas Menantier or David Banyankya was, and they just looked at me and laughed and pointed in the direction of the adobe houses and said, it's the one with the blue door, and then they giggled and all ran away laughing. So I drove a little further in, and I got out of the car and looked around, and all the Hopi houses had blue doors. And so I just walked up to the one that was directly in front of me, and I really was terrified that I'd be seen as a fraud or an interloper or who knows what. And I knocked on the door, and an old man came to the door, and it began to thunder and lightning, and the rain began to come down very hard. My children were asleep in the car, and this was a good thing, because then the elder looked up at the sky, he looked at me and invited me in. We sat in front of his pot-bellied stove on two overturned buckets. He offered me a cup of coffee. And the next hours were just lost in storytelling, wonderful, wonderful things. Time passed like magic. My children stayed asleep. And just about the time he and I came to the end of what we had to say to each other at that moment, then my children came in the door. And I was invited to come and live in Hopi. And David Menangier, one of the fathers of the Kachinas, or grandfathers of the Kachina clan, he and his wife Nora gave my children and myself their bed, and I began to live at Hopi for the next year.
That's an amazing story. Did you meet Tazula Brinkerhoff when you were...
No, the name isn't familiar.
She was a teacher of mine. She was an adopted daughter of David and Nora.
Oh, is that right? They were wonderful people. Wonderful.
And wrote a book during that period of time. And
what year was that?
Well, I want to say she was probably researching it in the 60s. And
I was there through 66 into 67.
Well, I've got the book here in front of me. Yeah, it looks like it was 71. But I know she was around them earlier than that, because she... I remember the stories. Of course, she had met, Rolling Thunder earlier. And so I think the relationship probably went back to the mid-60s, and you might... just not a run into her, and because I know there's pictures of David and Nora at Zula's house up in Salt Lake. She had been secretary to the governor of Utah, and
you know, there was a man named Larry, I don't remember his last name, who we were both going back, but he came from someplace else, but you know, for a while I didn't out of my other house, and so there I was going back and forth, and they thought in Oraibi, where David and Mina Luxa lived. Oh, that was your question, wasn't it? He was a special friend of theirs. So mostly in that beginning time, I was in Hood Villa, living at David and Nora's house. And then I spent time with Femina and Thomas Benyaki at their home, but lots and lots of time sleeping in my station wagon parked in front of Mina and John Monk's house in Oraibi. And it was in Oraibi that I think most of the knowledge was passed on to me. There were little incidents that happened in Hood Villa, but the lessons came from Oraibi.
Yeah, that'd be the center of the culture, definitely. What a story! That's amazing. They
I'm told it's the oldest continuously inhabited community in the Western Hemisphere.
That's right.
And they have great ties to the ancient Incas and Mayans and Toltecs.
Yeah, they have a parrot clan, so. You know, they had to come from someplace else.
Well, it was there that they told me about the Great Migration. And part of my love is to learn more and to share at whatever level of knowledge I have at the time. These migrations of people fascinate me. And when I lived among the Maori of Aotearoa, they told me about their great migrations, they call the Hikoi, in their wakas and canoes, and where they came from, and how long ago it was. There's so much we can talk about.
It's amazing. The one of my pet subjects is, of course, the Cherokees. We were told by our leaders in 1750 that we came from across the Eastern Ocean. And archaeologists and ethnologists point out that...
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
The only place that you, in the world that you can find dolichocephalic skulls, which are long, thin skulls, other than around the seacoasts worldwide, is up in the Appalachian Mountain chain between Alabama and Pennsylvania, surrounded by other cultures. And, of course, our language is completely different. So I think, and even the name Maori is so close to one of the ancient names of the Phoenicians, which is Mauru, in northern Africa today is Mauritania, Morocco, and I think it's very possible that that the Maori people, you know, may have some ancient connection with those
people.
Well,
let me share with you what Hakama Matu, who was thought by many as king of the Maoris in a village called Paorenga. What he told me, and he was able to recite his whole lineage that went back over 1,000 years, and he said that they came from Assyria on great ships, and that but there were times that there was land travel, and he talked about their people being up in Tibet and coming down in through India and going, you know, this different journey he showed me. And then he said that we came around the tip of South America, and our people, some of our people, stopped and created a community in what is known as Easter Island, and they call it Rapa Nui, and they still speak old Maori there, and that's where the Akuaku statues that are built on the cliffs overlooking the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they have a whole thing that they recite about going into Tahiti and Hawaii, and then also I do believe that the Haida people in the Queen Charlotte Islands may be part of that great migration. And then he said then they finally, their last stop, I believe, was, and, you know, and of course they're peeling off in different groups and then colonize those areas. And the last to be colonized was Aotearoa, the land of the long white cloud. And that was also told to me in a mystery school called Manu Ariki, and that's an ancient mystery school. Their genealogy is very, very important to them there.
That's astounding.
You know, before I start telling these people's tales, I did a meditation while I was preparing to talk to you. And trying to think, at first I couldn't imagine, there's so much to talk about, so much to share knowledge with, and I couldn't think of how to begin. There's different parts here, like there's of course my own personal story, which is still going through its changes. There is just little anecdote stories of people I have met, who've been my teachers. There are political aspects to this, and then there are the lessons, what I called, in the beginning when I started teaching, I called them 11th hour tools for spiritual activists who are in a hurry, for spiritual warriors in a hurry. And then the Hopi called me back to them in April of 93 and said to me, Chukosh, you've been telling the people that this is 11th hour. Now you must go back and tell them that it is the hour and there are things to be considered. So there are the tools and then there are the sacred stories. And in my meditation, it was all a jumble, and then it came to me that perhaps before I start telling other tribe stories for them, that I should probably do a sage ceremony and then maybe start with some shorter sacred stories that, and then wherever that leads to.
Oh.
Right?
Oh.
I think that that's a value to the people, and that folks aren't going to be particularly interested in my personal story, but they do want to hear what are the sacred stories. We might as well get them before they lose interest. Okay?
Sounds real good.
Okay. I just feel more comfortable preparing myself in this way. And so I have before me in abalone white sage. And with the miracle that is fire, I take that element and I take it to this sage. And there comes from this sage smoke, sacred smoke. And many people have seen people just take and waft the smoke over their bodies. But I'm going to do it now in each piece so that people will understand what in fact they are actually doing. And to also ask people to never call it smudging again, because it's a wrong word. This is a plant of purification. This smoke cleans and clears one's spirit, and to smudge means quite the opposite. All right? So here, now with conscious intent, I take this sacred smoke over my head that I may purify my mind to seek truth. And now I take the sacred smoke to purify my eyes so that when truth is before me, I will see it. I take this sacred smoke and I purify my ears so that when another speaks their truth, I will be able to hear it. I take this sacred smoke and I purify my mouth, for it is from this place that the Great Spirit has given me to speak my truth. And I take this sacred smoke and with conscious intent, I purify my heart, for it is in this place we all know the truth. I take this sacred smoke and with conscious intent, I purify my whole being that I may be here in a sacred manner with you all. Go
home.
Let's start with a petroglyph that I'm looking at here. It's a Chumash petroglyph, and it was sent to me, and I guess it's repeated in many, many areas where the Chumash were, and that was a large, large area. This particular one, I believe, was taken from the Carrizo Plains. And but it is also in the mountains of along the coastal mountains of Santa Barbara down to Topanga. And I called it one of the Shumash creation stories.
Uh-huh.
See if I can describe this petroglyph for you. There are two shapes of figures. They're the same size. They are in a dusty kind of a brick red color. And they are joined together in their arms that are next to each other. And then their outer arms are reaching up to the heavens. There is like a great sunburst of yellow coming from their heads, and at one point it connects those beams of yellow light coming from their heads. They're connected there in the head and the arm. What I see this to be is that there was a time before matter when all was just energy. And there were two sovereign energies that did not come together. And one was the positive, one was the negative. One was the sacred feminine creative energy, and the other one was the sacred masculine creative energy. And until they came together, there was no form, only energy and space. When they came together, each remaining independent and yet joined in thought and in deed, they both became pregnant. And this shows a great blue surrounded by yellow circle in their bellies. Both the sacred feminine creative energy and the sacred masculine creative energy, in joining their thought and deed, both became pregnant. And then from their bodies, the great rains filled with the seeds of all life and form as we know it, and it rained down, creating the earth, and as it soaked into the earth, and then from that earth, all life came. It's a beautiful picture, and you can't tell which is male and which is female. They are the same size, they are equal, they are in perfect balance. They are separate, and yet they have agreed to join together, and then both are pregnant. And I love that story.
That's a wonderful story.
The Maori have a similar story about Papa Tuanuku, who they say is Mother Earth, and Rangotani is with Father Sky. And before there was form, there were just these two great lovers, and they held each other so close, so tightly in their love and in this embrace. Well, there was another god named Maui who came along, much like our coyote figure, and he decided that these two beings needed some space. There was not room for anything else. So he planted a tree in Papa Tuanuku's belly. And as this tree, the great Totara tree, grew and began to spread its branches and forced a space now between Rangotani and Papa Tuanuku. And so that from this longing for each other and the great love in that was now separated or their embrace. From that, then, all things grew and came to be.
Oh.
So sometimes in wedding ceremonies, I talk about that you can love so much, but there needs to be some space that allows for balance and each one to create as they were made to do.
That's true.
So that's just a petroglyph. When I lived among the Hopi people, they would take me out, particularly John Marksa, would take me out and explain to me the different sacred places on that particular mesa and what happened in their history and when the Mormons came and took their children and built a church there, and they were warned not to do that, that they were building on a sacred site. And they built anyway, and how it was destroyed by lightning. And as we would walk along the very uneven ground around Oribe, and no matter how careful I was, I found myself tripping and going up and down on this uneven ground. And then I got a funny feeling and noticed that this old man, John Loxa, Mina Loxa's husband, that he was just kind of coasting really smooth, and there wasn't even the motion in his shoulders of someone walking. And I looked down in some amazing way, expecting what I next saw. And what that was what I now call skimming. His feet were moving just above the surface of the earth, like maybe, I'm holding my fingers up, my joint finger, maybe 2 inches, 2.5 inches, right along the earth, and just as smooth as could be. That happened to me about 3 times.
My word.
Then, and that was around 1966, I guess, toward the end.
Yeah, Handsome Lake reported that same kind of phenomenon with the three that appeared to him.
The Tibetans know it well as well.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, I just call it skimming. It reminds me a little bit, well, I don't know, why do I call it skimming? I don't know, maybe like when you toss a flat stone out across the water, and when it moves just above the surface of the water, in one of those really good skips.
Huh. I know.
It's quite something. I've never done it on purpose. It just snuck up on me a couple of times.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond.
Put it
under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
I think those sort of things that we may have all done them at will, that all of those so-called secrets or miracles were a normal part of our lives at one time on this planet. I think we are really very, very old. They're constantly pushing back the how old they think humans have been here, how old the Earth is, literally billions of years. A lot of things can happen in that time, and the Hopi say it's this is the fourth world than three times before. There have been great civilizations with great technology and without a balance. And when they did that, they affected the balance of Mother Earth. Then she washes herself clean. The Hopi, the first time was by fire. And the second time, then another civilization eventually grew and took on a great technology that, again, affected the balance of Mother Earth. This time the world washed itself clean by ice. So that's like water and fire, ice. Yes, and then the third world, those survivors, again, through a long, long time, were able to create another great society with a powerful technology that, again, was not in balance with the energy of Mother Earth. She washed herself clean, and this time it was with a great deluge of water. The Hopi say that those that survived, for them, were underground, and that it was then Masao, the great messenger, who reached down with a great ladder and brought the people back out onto the surface of the earth, and took the great truth, the truth that that contains all things great and small, microcosm and macrocosm, the great truth, and divided it into many parts, gave these parts to the people and sent them in the four directions, each bearing a portion of the great truth. And during this time, they were told that they were to look for signs in the sky and when to stop and build and when to move on. And they were to tell this story at every solstice, winter solstice, that it would be remembered that people needed to know that they had only a portion of the truth, that there were others who traveled with their portion of the sacred truth in the other direction. But this migration took a very long time, and in time there were those who forgot the old stories, who began to think that they had the only truth or the most important truth. And then when they thought of that, then the sacred hoop of the nations was broken, and they began to make a religion from their piece of truth. They built walls around it and doors that shut out the truth of others. Once the great hoop of the nations was broken, then they began to fill that vacuum, that space, with the technology. And in time, like the other three worlds, that technology went out of balance and began to affect the balance of Mother Earth. And that's where we are now. And the Hopi warned us that David Menangi said that if unchecked, that we would take it to its inevitable course, and we would create a gourd of ashes that would fall from the sky and destroy all life as we knew it, boil the oceans. And then they also said that there would come at this time another technology, and that would be the technology of communication. That if one, as I've seen the petroglyphs there on the rock between the cliff between Arrivi and Gagotsmuni, it shows you're out in space, and how they knew this, and that there's this earth in a perfect sphere, and around the earth, they said, would be a shimmering spider webs in which the people of the four directions could communicate with one another. And that if they did this in a sacred manner, and they spoke their truth in a sacred manner, and they listened to each other in a sacred manner, then this would mend those fragments of truth, and the truth would be known, and in doing that, the sacred hoop of the nations would be mended. and we would survive into the fifth world.
That's amazing, because each employee during his orientation at Cherokee Nation headquarters is told that the elders in the 1950s said that someday the world would be surrounded by a spider web.
Yeah.
And
World Wide Web.
That's right. The Sioux people, Ed McGaw, when we interviewed him a few weeks ago, he said that that this would be the time of communication, and that if it was used for good, it could be used to bring people together.
Exactly.
It's absolutely amazing, the parallels that one can discover when you start to look at all these prophecies, and that's why I do it, because it's just so fascinating.
Yes, well, when I was very young, I was in my, about my mid-20s, when I spent that time in Oraibi and Hotzilla and New Oraibi. And at that time, because I had not been raised in this tradition, I didn't know what to do with this knowledge. And it seemed like, in a way, I was finally being spoken truth to. But in my, say, 25 years of life, I had swallowed so much garbage, so many social lies and untruths and patronizing things, that it was like I was already full with so much junk that every time they gave me a truth, there would be this huge burst of enlightenment, and then this, soon after, followed by this moment, really hard moment of indigestion, where I would have to go in deep and kick out all kinds of cultural untruths. And that's the thing, is that we just need to empty out and open up, because this is the time of communication and time where we should listen to everyone. I had a teacher once who said, "You're all young," and be like sponges. Just take it all in, listen to it all, ask people their stories, find out how it is for the people of the earth and different cultures and things. Take it all in, and those truths will connect like dots together, and all the rest will just fall out by its own weight. And so, you know, don't stop the flow by being suspicious or judging. Just witness it, look at it, you know, and right now I call it the time for connecting the dots. We've all been gathering information for a long time, and we're sacred beings. We can do this.
Reminds me of Uncle John's advice to everyone. He said that everyone needs to lose the word struggle from their vocabulary. He said there's a river flowing very fast, which is oddly like what Edgar Casey said. And he said that not to fight the current, just to get out in the middle and go with it.
Uncle John the Iroquois elder says, "We must know that there is a river flowing now very fast. It is so swift and so great that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel as though they're being torn apart." Uncle John says that this river has its destination, that all that we are asked to do is to push off from the shore into the middle of that river, keep our eyes open and our head above water, and I say, celebrate. See who you find in that river with you at this time, and celebrate. And that's what Uncle John then added, because he said, "Oh, you're adding something to my story, are you?" And I said, "Yes, we need to celebrate." He said, "That's good, because this is an important time. He says there are many people who have gotten that they're addicted to struggle. And he said you'll never get off the wheel that way. And so what we want to do at this time, so we don't burn out, is just kick the word, the whole concept, struggle. Just kick it right out. Get rid of it. Flush it down the toilet. Stick it in the ground and walk away. And that we are to go on with our lives and do what we do, but do it with a sense of celebration. And then we will never burn out, and others will be attracted and want to join us in this celebration of getting done what must be done. And you can add that or connect that to every aspect of what it takes to be on the planet right now.
I couldn't help but notice after reading that two or three times that most of the people in the American Indian movement, when they sign off a letter, it says yours in struggle, and then they sign their name. So
there's no chance then for them ever to get beyond that mindset. It just goes round and round. You know, we need to celebrate the life it is that we want to create now. You celebrate it as though it were so, and it is. But in struggle, it's exhausting.
It is, and you
like the word smudge. I don't think they really mean that.
Yeah, smudge sounds something that's dirty and black. But I've known a lot of people that.
You're getting hard for me to hear.
Well, I know a lot of folks that were involved in the American Indian movement, and a lot of them get burned out because it's just. It's just so hard and so stressful, and you can't see short-term progress. It's a long struggle. So I think Uncle John's advice was good advice, just to go with the flow.
Well, it changes everything, and it gives you some energy to do it. You know, we can only struggle so long. And then, of course, there's the terrible, what do they call it, lateral violence that happens, I understand, with suppressed people, where what is pushing them down seems so huge and out of reach that they begin to be aggressive and violent in spiritual ways to each other. And that's been a terrible problem among the Native American new communities, in that they tear each other down.
They do. Yeah,
instead of supporting.
There's a lot of young people that get involved in that kind of behavior, and it's so self-destructive. By the way, I always have wondered, by any chance, is Uncle John, John Fadden?
I don't know. Is John Fadden Iroquois?
Yeah, he, John, pretty much single-handedly, I guess he and Jake Swamp, and maybe a few other elders, they literally brought the Six Nations back from, there was just hardly anything going on culturally. They taught an entire generation, retaught them there, you know, along with Mad Bear Anderson and a few others, you know, retaught them how to govern themselves and got them to be proud again of their culture. His son, Ray, runs the Six Nations Museum. I believe it's in Onondaga, New York.
I don't know if this is the same person. I never knew him other than as Uncle John. And the first couple of times were long phone calls. And then I finally did meet him, and I was able to stay in a place up in Santa Barbara, a gathering of people for about 3 days, and he was there. All that I know is that at the time, he was living with his family somewhere near the Kern River. Excuse me. Whoops, I'm sitting in front of an open window. So I don't know, but those men, they have done some wonderful, wonderful work, and I just am so so grateful that they're there.
Well, it's certainly good. Certainly good words of advice. What did the elders tell you would happen once the migration was completed? Did they talk with you about that?
Yes. That if, in using this technology of the shimmering spider's web, that if we put the emphasis on that and that communication, and then, you know, it's going to be one or the other. If we don't communicate and communicate truth, then that's it. We have now created weapons so terrible that we may look like the planet Mars in, who knows, 10 years. You know, we have that capable, that crazy capability to do that to ourselves. Or if in fact we go and put the emphasis on the technology of communication and mend the sacred hoop by honoring each other and listening to each other's truths, then the Hopi say that at that time they will intermarry and that all people will become mixed, that we will truly become one people in honor and respect and in a sacred manner, and that this time we may go from this, the fourth world, into the fifth without that whole terrible destruction, that it's like an evolution. Huh. And there will be peace and abundance for all.
So it's up to us, and like they said, the ones that you have been waiting for are you.
Yes, we are the ones that we've been waiting for. Yes.
Of course, the flip side of that is, you know, I've met the enemy and they are us.
Yeah, ouch. Yeah, well, it's all a paradox, isn't it, when you get down to it.
I'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of WiseFoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfasts and 10 delicious dinner entrees from WiseFoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year supply from WiseFoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingraham, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why? Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow. But tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quiñones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and Primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of 5 exotic plants that have been around for centuries.
Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Ken Yonez has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better. I feel a lot better and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Well, yeah, like you, I wasn't raised in the culture, but it really is interesting because I was brought up. My parents weren't particularly religious, but they believed in spiritual things, and especially had a respect for prophecy I just couldn't help growing up, once I started hearing about the native prophecies, I couldn't help notice the similarities, but for a while I thought, oh well, you have no way of knowing, those may just be prophecies that native people had borrowed from Christian people, and that's one of the first assumptions, which is a mistaken assumption that people could make. And then I looked a little bit deeper, like I always do, and realized that the breadth and width and length of these prophecies is so great and so much more voluminous than anything. Even the Tibetans, when they came and met the Hopi, they commented that they were astounded at the prophetic tradition. They said, oh, well, we have lots of prophecies too, but they're written down and stored in the basement. And they said, we'll have to go home and brush them off. But
1973, that was. They've been here a couple of times since then with the Hopi, but that was the big time that it happened, and they met each other. The Hopi were expecting them. They had prophecies that even named the particular color of the sect that would come. And then they went down into the Kivas together and stayed there for, from what I understand, several days, and just were in wonder and joy and very serious and very happy in so many places where they had the same stories and missing pieces for each other. That's how I got to the Maori in New Zealand. I had a radio program in Monterey County for 5 years called Songs for the Earth, Mending the Sacred Hoop. And while I was there, I met two musicians, Daniel Becker Callegos and Pony Vigil, two Native American musicians. And so they wanted to put some music behind the sacred stories that I had been told, the creation, migration, and prophecy stories. So we filled a tape, this was before CD, with about 54 minutes of the Chumash, some of Uncle John's There is a River, and the Hopi stories, and stories about one of the Cherokee elders, Nahana Yawahu. And somehow a copy of that tape made it to New Zealand, and I got a letter saying, here is your ticket to Aotearoa. We expect you at this time. We have missing pieces. Oh, you have missing pieces of our stories, and we have some for you.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh,
but
yeah.
By any chance, did you meet Maki Ruka? Yeah.
I don't think so.
Maki he's walked west now, but another one of my guests traveled with him quite a bit, and Maki did quite a bit of teaching, and just wonder if it was pronounced Maki actually, Maki Ruka.
Yeah.
But he's one of their elders, and. Well, isn't that interesting? So you got a invitation to go down there. Isn't that amazing how everything's connected?
Yeah, It certainly isn't, especially now. And one of the things that I was warned, who told me, which of the elders, I think it was Thomas Manyakya, said to me that in the time of the purification, there would be a great polarization. And there was no middle ground. There were the people that were for life and living. And the Maoris would have called them the Tuiwi. And then there would be those who operated from darkness and only created death. Well, the Maori called those people the Pākehā. And here you are. I mean, look at it. You've got our whole government is a death cult, you know. And we've been lied to just severely. It's 1984 and then some. And it's a death cult. That's what they're manufacturing. That's what they're making. And that's what they're not blowing up. They're polluting. And I love my seafood. And I can't just, I having to live like everyone so defensively because they're literally poisoning the earth. They have no right for that, to do that. And I have grandchildren now, and I think about that.
Yeah,
so here's our polarization time for sure. Have you read the story about the Blanket of Hope? You mentioned a few minutes ago about the Diné prophecies.
Yeah, I've been...
This is one of them, and that blanket actually exists, you know.
Yes, there's a picture of it that I borrowed off of your website, and people can see it at prophecykeepers.com.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And why don't you go ahead and tell us about it?
Well, the website, do you know, is it .org or .com? I forget.
Chakosh.org.
Oh. Well, it has actually its own website. It's www.theblanketofhope.org or .com.
That's right. That's right. You do. It does. It does have its own website.
Yeah.
Let me look it up here.
Okay.
And go ahead. While I'm doing that, go ahead and tell us about.
Well, that blanket was woven by Asonia Begay, and it was brought to me by three Navajo women elders, and that would have been around 1986, I think, maybe early 87, during the protest against making Snipper O'Sara Franciscan priest, saint. And so it came about that time, and it's a beautiful, magnificent blanket. It's exactly 6 feet long by, 2 feet.
Looks like it's 6 by just a little under 3 feet. It is theblanketofhope.org.
Oh, it is. www.theblanketofhope.org. Well, it's a very, very important story, and it shows the three court maidens. I'll just share with you how the story was told to me. This blanket is a blanket of prophecy, and it shows that the main figures are three court maidens, and they are bearing arrows, ascending and descending. These are arrows of truth. And the story of the blanket goes that one day we will find this world in famine and despair. And it is because truth has not been spoken. And if we are to survive, it will be because the truth, the feminine truth that is in every woman and in every man, must step forward, and that if those arrows find their mark, then, and the arrows ascending, descending, to me that means there are truths that will now ascend, and some truths that we have been fooled into where false truths must be sent. And he said that if the feminine truth steps forward, and there are truths that descend and other truths that ascend, and if they find their mark, then it shows corn growing on either side of the corn maidens. And that means that the reason why we're in all the trouble that we are, if you get all the way down, this is sort of like the string theory of what's happened to Mother Earth, and that is that we are out of balance. The Creator has made things in symmetry, in balance, so that they work, and so they can be in harmony. And there isn't just men. There are men and women. And that there is a male truth and a feminine truth that need to work together. But the feminine truth that men are ashamed of in themselves or afraid to show, and the feminine truth that is in women, which has been suppressed, is like a great bird that was created with two wings to fly. One wing is very strong and the other one is bound. As long as it is like that, this bird is going to go round in circles, knock a lot of things over, create a big mess, and never get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That everything, the truth of everything is the truth of everything. That we must release that other wing so it can balance, and then that bird can take flight. We are in this terrible time of aggression, destruction, one-upmanship, king of the mountain, who's got more. And, you know, this is a very masculine energy, and it is not tempered by the feminine. And it is the feminine who really does mature earlier, is the social one, is loves communication. This needs to balance that masculine. If we were in balance, we wouldn't be spending trillions of dollars on war machines and only few millions on education and health.
Oh.
We need to take care of our people. How can they call themselves, what is it, the first law of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not kill. There's no excuse. It is no more an evolved solution than the caveman's use.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the worst. So easy to desecrate and destroy. So anyway, that's my big soapbox stand on that, but to me it's so clear. Oh, by the way, I took this blanket with me to New Zealand, and one night I was in one of their meeting houses called a marae, and I was asked to tell the story of the blanket of hope. So I told that story. Oh, by the way, it doesn't promise that the feminine truth will step forward. It says if the feminine truth steps forward and the arrows find their mark. We have to make that choice. It's up to us who are the ones we've been waiting for. So I finished telling the story, and there was a Kauia, elder grandmother, Maori, sitting in the front, and she was all excited, and she was rolling back and forth on her haunches, and she kept pointing at the blanket, and she said, and finally, she just couldn't keep herself still anymore, and she said, the border, you didn't tell them about the border. Well, I had never thought about the border. It's a beautiful border of spirals and steps, sort of.
Looks kind of like waves.
Huh?
Looks kind of like waves.
Yeah. Well, she said, look at our flax leaf wall designs that we have here. And, of course, they were the same thing that you see in the Mayan and Aztec carvings on the temples. And she said, tell them about the border. And I said, well, it's a very nice border, but I don't know what it means. And she said, oh, well, we do. And she hops right up and she explained the border to me, which is also in the website about it. It shows it. And she said, you see, these spirals are the truth of nature. If you want to understand life, you must take off your shoes, she said, and feel the earth, smell the earth, get grounded that way, and know that the laws that govern all of our lives come from our connection to nature. And then she said, and do you see the stairways that are supported by the spiral of the laws of nature? And I said, yes. She said, well, we call that the staircase to heaven. And I started to panic, and I stopped her right there, not wanting to be disrespectful. But I said, does this come from the missionary teachings? And she said, no, 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 she said. This is our life, and every one of these steps is an obstacle. And what you do is every time you meet another step, instead of calling it an obstacle, like the word struggle, you just say thank you, and you take that step. And for a while, you rest on that step, and you've learned that lesson, and pretty soon there's another step. Just say thank you, and take that step. And she said, if you keep doing that, and that's what we're here for, then eventually you come to the knowledge that you've embodied.
Reminds me of Kung Tzu wrote The Art of War, and I think he mentioned that the word crisis really means opportunity.
Yes, isn't that wonderful? You know, in a sweat lodge, the first time I ever went into a sweat lodge was in 1978 in the occupation of Point Conception, where I received my name in Santa Barbara. And I wore this kind of rayon muumuu dress inside. I didn't have a bathing suit. I don't like that anyway. But so I went in there, and I started to get so hot and that I just became terrified. It was so dark, so close, so sweaty. And the heat was so intense that it actually melted the back yoke on my dress.
Oh, my word.
So it really did get that hot, and I was very shamed, but I had to go out after the third round. Then Archie Fire Lane Deer, who was there, said, you must go back in again, and this time you sit with me. And so I sat next to him, and what he told me was this. He said, the heat from the stone people is like the challenges of life. It's your fears, your ego, your attachment and connection to things that are keeping you down and confused. And so he said, what you do is don't lie down on the ground. Don't cover yourself from the heat. But instead, when it comes, lean forward into the heat and with your hands bring it to you. Because like life, when the difficulties come and the fear comes, it's going to happen anyway. So instead of being the victim and just being hit by it, reach into it with your being and bring it to you and say thank you.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated and freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Maria.
Put it under
Osmond.
Your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Maria Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
And then it changes like our nemesis. Where the heat is too much for you. He said, oh, a grandmother then added a part to it. She said, it is not the events in our life which cause us the pain. It is our resistance. And so when you remove the resistance and you welcome it to you, it's going to come anyway. You might as well welcome it to you and say thank you. Then there is this instant, and you can feel it. Suddenly, it isn't too hot. It's a part of you. There's no resistance. It moves through you. It's a great, this is why I call it teachings for spiritual warriors in a hurry. Because these wonderful spiritual truths, they don't take years and years in a mystery school. They don't take sitting on a pillow forever and, whatever you're supposed to do by that route. The truth is so much there that in a moment you can test it and know that it works. And it used to be a part of our culture. We all knew this, but we forgot.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that really astounded me when I started walking down this path was when I discovered that the elders said that at this time it would be a time when all of the old beliefs, the lost beliefs, the medicine societies that had died would all begin to come back, that all the truths would be taught through spirit. And then, of course, the counterpart to that from the Eastern Hemisphere in the Bible, it says that this is the time of the restitution of all things, spoken of by all the mouths of all the holy prophets. And that kind of thing can really get your attention. And that's the time that we live in. And, you know, my wife and I were just talking about this the other night. I'll be 50 in December. She's your age. She's 61. And I was saying to her, Betty, I said, do you realize that the world that we live in now is completely different? It's almost like a different planet from the world that you grew up in the 50s and I grew up in the 60s. And she says, oh, yes. She says, it's just completely different place. And, it was prophesied. Absolutely amazing, the things that are happening.
Yes, it is. But, you know, we have tools. I used to teach different courses or gatherings, and in this Tools for Spiritual Warriors, the first series was Sacred Breath. And there is so much that is controlled by the breath.
Now, did you say sacred breath?
Breath, and in breathing.
Well, one of the One of the things that every once in a while Spirit whispers things to me, and now this would be going back to about 10 years ago. It was about the time that my first wife passed away. Just before she passed away, there were four things that were told me in one night. And one of the things was, remember the sacred breath. So I, the implications of that are, well, it's something I already know, and I have to figure out what it is, and then the sacred breath, is it breath? Is it the master of life? Who's the sacred breath? Breath is everything, and it's nothing too, and it's just one of those things that's had me thinking for a long time. It's just like, once or twice a year, Creator will tell me something, and he gave me a prophecy in August of 2000. He said the three have been trying to come for the past 400 years, but they have been unable to come because the people have not been ready. Mm-hmm. And he said they are coming in 2004, so get ready.
Did you say the three?
The three.
Oh.
And I got to thinking, that's really interesting. Are we talking about Masao and his two helpers? Or are we talking about the three that appeared to Handsome Lake? Three Corn Maidens. Can be seen several times in the Bible, the Book of Mormon. There were the three that appeared to Abraham. So it's a very mystical thing when you start talking about the three and what could happen this year. Of course, Edgar Cayce, there's a very little-known prophecy that Edgar Cayce left concerning 2004, which was just announced not too long ago. He said that in 2004... there would be a new race that would be established. And when you said that we would all intermarry, the first thing I heard that Edgar Cayce prophecy was, well, that has to be the Rainbow Tribe, the real fulfillment of it, not what we see nowadays, but something that's really true and lasting.
Can I offer you the Shumash creation about the people of the heart?
Please do.
Okay. This was told to me by Grandfather Victor Lopez, and also one of our Shumash people, Kotlota. And it was told to me in 1978 when I was there at Point Conception, and then also later when I was to live with Grandfather Victor Lopez Gallego. And I don't know if this is the whole story intact, or I can only give you what it is that was shared with me. And he started off by saying, and I believe he was talking about the Shumash people, I don't know, you can draw your own conclusions, but these were his words. He said, "We are not of this planet. We are star people. We came from the Pleiades, the seven sisters, in silent ships powered by the sun. We came to a great continent of land that went out in the Pacific Ocean. And there we brought a great technology, and it was a technology of the power of the sun through crystals. And with this technology, we were able to move great masses of earth, create great channels or irrigation, and to," he spoke of there being a way of anti-gravity, and also, anti-gravity hot lasers, power of the crystal, or the sun by the crystal. And then there were the people of the mind who were not satisfied with that much power. And what they did was they took the natural crystal, changed its shape. I believe he said it was something from concave to convex or the other way around, but somehow there was some changes done fooling around with those crystals. And when they did that, and they became even more powerful and began to affect the gravity of Mother Earth, and the pole shifted, there was great upheavals and earthquakes, and land masses began to sink, and others were forced upward, and they caused a great schism with the people. And they were divided, became divided to the people of the mind and the people of the heart. And the people of the heart warned the people of the mind that they were no longer in balance. And the kind of technology that they were using was now very dangerous and could destroy the land and the life as we knew it. But the people of the mind figured that they had created this problem, and that if they became more powerful, they would be able to set it right. Well, it didn't work. And our land began, over a period of time, to disappear into the ocean, not the Pacific Ocean. And I'm told that there were those of us who were the memorizers. And over a period of time only, I think that we might have been aquatic to begin with, but became the dolphin. And they went into the ocean to survive and to remember these stories about what had happened to us. And the land disappeared. Some people say that there was a great rainbow bridge that connected the sinking continent to the west coast here. And there were those who survived by coming that way. Now, some say that the dolphins became the people who fell into the sea, but frankly, I think the dolphins are so smart that I prefer to believe the story about that they were the memorizers.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at the skeleton of a dolphin, of course, they have hip bones, they have a pelvis, they feed their babies with breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at their fins and their tail, that it's actually the skeleton of two legs, and there are actually five phalange finger bones in each of the fins. And so, you know, they must have been land-oriented at one time, and the only reason they have five fingers is to manipulate, to use them. And everyone should take a look at the skeleton of a dolphin. They're in the books. It's quite remarkable. Well, the story finishes up by saying there were those who survived by going into the sea. They were the memorizers, our ancient ones. And then others who managed to survive by coming to the western edge of this continent, and that they could live in abundance and in peace and in harmony as long as they kept the laws of living within the code of nature, then they would survive and they would be comfortable. But they were warned, and this is what Kodmoda said at this point, he said that they were warned that there might come again the people of the mind, and that they would approach them from east of our continent, and that if they got a foothold, then there would be no stopping them until they had pushed the people of the heart to the western edge of this land. And with the people of the heart, they were of many colors and cultures, found themselves with their backs against. When they could be pushed no further, an amazing thing would happen. They would begin to turn around, recognize each other, and from this recognition at the western edge of this continent, the remembering of the turning around, they would create a great wave of the heart that would move across from the western edge of this continent to the east, and then around the whole world, restoring harmony and balance.
Well, certainly, looks like it's coming true, because when you think about the fulfillment of the when the Hopi prophecy began to be fulfilled, when the young people, the grandchildren of and the great grandchildren of the ones who fought at Greasy Grass, the Custer fight, that fulfillment of prophecy, the hippie movement, you know, which became the New Age movement, and which has become so many things, but these people, well, Grandfather Rolling Thunder called them the reincarnates, and I see that these people are much more seem to be much more accepting of what's being taught than the Native people today. It seems like the young Native people today tend to get involved with the struggle and they go join AIM and they're just and it's really funny, they didn't live through most of them didn't live through the boarding school years, and you know, they weren't beaten by their teachers, but even though they didn't go through those experiences, they've internalized that anger, which I think is really interesting. And
well, it's much easier to criticize and condemn than it is to build, you know, and create.
Sure is.
But the elders aren't like that.
No, they aren't. They really aren't.
It was a terrible thing that happened to them, when the children were forcibly removed from their families and their culture and raised in these penal institutions, not allowed to speak their language, put in ill-fitting clothes and treated like they were dirty and something was wrong with them.
I know
what... There's a generation that reclaimed those. There are those among the white societies that started going back to Celtic traditions and the Druid schools and Margitic and Buddhist, and talking about the goddess time. Aquarian culture and living with the earth, and people going back into rediscovering the Egyptian, the Mayan, the Zoroastrian, the Kabbalah, Hindu, Sufi. It was just so exciting. I was just the right age. I was in my teens in the 50s and in 60s, I was in my 20s and emancipated, and I was in the middle of it, and it was extraordinary that anything that lasted really such a short time was so huge. It was like the very air crackled with the electricity of love and celebration. Tremendous.
Isn't that something?
Did you want me to talk about the Hopi pen?
Please, yeah, absolutely.
And then you've got it on your website as well?
I've got the Hopi Ted and the Uncle John both. They're very important.
Well, I would really like to give it right now myself, because people have already, with the stories of the blanket of hope, the Hopi Ted, people must realize that the oral tradition is sacred, absolutely inviolate. The words that the elders use are extraordinary.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandim, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients, activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandim has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities, such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandim reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandim reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing Nrf2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
When I committed them to memory and then wrote them down, stuck it on my refrigerator, on my medicine cabinet wall, just looked at them over and over again, that there are dimensions and levels to each thing they say, and so it must not be changed. As I look on the internet these days, there are a few places where people have taken my words. We also had them Xeroxed and passed a lot of them out. And they have reproduced them on the internet as they were given. And yet I'm very disappointed. In many places I find that the wording has been changed, and in doing so, it's simply not as clear. It's confusing. People take the elders' words, like whatever it was that was in the Bible, and tend to use them for their own agendas. And it's terribly important within an oral tradition, and I will speak especially for the Native American, when you get something that comes out of the elders and the traditionalists, you must. And it's not difficult to commit it to memory to not take a license with it, because you're cheating yourself of the learning curve that it creates. So anyway, that's my little, what do you call that thing you stick in the front? Disclaimer.
Oh yeah, your preamble. But this is absolutely true, because people of the book don't know how it works with traditional people. They don't understand that the traditional people have memorized everything. These things have been passed down for thousands of years, and every word is weighed and calculated to have its effect.
Yes, right. Well, what I'll do is I'll quickly tell you how the Hopi Dance came about. In 1993, I was living in Northern California, and it was a terrible, terrible time among Indian communities. There was a group that called themselves, Center for Spirit. That's right.
Right.
Like the moral majority was neither. I don't know who these people, I could name a name, but I don't know, maybe I'll just leave it at that.
All right.
They were attacking all Native peoples who were sharing knowledge of the Native American way, the earth knowledge. Well, as Thomas Banyakya said, this is critical, that this knowledge needs to be shared. It must be shared. It is because it's been... hasn't been shared, that we're in such a mess. And he said, on this turtle island, at this time, by the time of the day of purification comes, there will be people from all the directions who will found themselves here. People from the east, people from the south, people from the north, Europeans, Asians, Africans, all the peoples will find themselves here on Turtle Island. And they will bring their knowledge, their portion of the truth that was given by Masao, and people will gravitate toward it. They'll want to hear it and learn it, practice it. The last piece that will be offered, and it will be the most difficult there will be a great struggle around it, and that will be the knowledge of the people of the West. That is the American continent. People are so used to calling a Western culture, Western thought, and that naming Europeans that way. Well, they're the people of the North. There was a whole continent to the west of them that they didn't seem to include or acknowledge. So here, this Earth knowledge is a home for all of our relations, living in right relation with the earth in a sacred manner. The kind of things that come out of the Native American culture is the last, and that's the Native culture of Turtle Island, and it is the last that will be listened to. But if all the truth of the four directions are come here, and the sacred hoop is mended on Turtle Island, will have the peace and the prosperity and all that is prophesied about the fifth world. Well, there was this group, and they took on the mantle of Native American, and what they did was attack anyone who was sharing Native American wisdom, Earth people. And to the point where there were threats on people's lives, there were just terrible things. There were letters sent out to discredit people, libel and slander all over the place.
Still going on.
And attacks, that's right, it is still going on. I'm very suspicious of that group, because any true Native American group that's working in the light and the truth never has hardly any money to work from. They're always struggling. But I understand that there was several Native clone groups that seem to have plenty of shiny jackets and walkie-talkies and cell phones and all kinds of equipment and stuff in this Center for Spirit that also called itself the Bay Area Indian Community, and there was none. There's no such thing, not as far as an organized group is concerned. It never had an address, it never had a phone number, it had a post office box. And they sent out all kinds of letters and denouncing these Indian elders and casting doubts on them. And so many people, non-Indian organizations, stopped sponsoring these elders. They were afraid because they didn't want to be politically incorrect or making a mistake, or they were afraid of being bombed, and there were those threats that were made. So all of the venues that made it possible for us to talk to the people of other colors and other cultures were closed down to us by people purporting to be of our own blood. And that was very, very serious, and there was just paranoia and fear, and it was very ugly. It made all Indian people look bad and confused everyone else. So one day I got on the phone and I called Thomas Manyakia, and he's almost never home this day. He answered himself, and I told him, I said, please help me remember. There are many people. over saying I shouldn't be telling these stories or teaching these spirit tools. And so I want to ask you, do you remember when I was with you, and it was over 30 years ago, yes, I remember very well, and I said, the story of the Hopi prophecy and the different things that you told me, were, did you tell me those things just for myself alone? Were they a secret? Or I was under the impression that everyone could gain great value by learning these things, and that you wanted people to be told, and that's why you told me. And he said, yes, that's right. Well, I just heaved a great sigh because I had begun to think that I was getting this flack because I was doing something that I wasn't supposed to, and I'd gotten it mixed up in 30-some years. And so he said, yes, you are right. He said, we did give this to you to share with others who we hoped would then share it with others. And he said, the elders will want to speak to you. And he said, can you come now? And I was going to school. I'd gone back to school at the time. And then I realized this was right at the beginning of the Easter break. And I said, yes, I can leave tomorrow. And he said, good, the elders will want to meet with you. So the next day I drove exactly 1,000 miles from Highway 101 to Third Mesa and New Orleans, where Thomas lives. And so then I went to his house, and I stayed there for several days, and the elders didn't come, and he didn't come, and I was getting, it was getting to be about time where I was going to have to go back home. And then the daughter, the oldest daughter of Chief Mina Monksa, John Monksa, came to me, and she said, the elders will not come to you while you're here. And I was confused by that. I didn't understand what she meant. She said, so pack your clothes, take up your things, and I will take you to Arati.
Ah.
So I went with her to her mother's house. Of course, Mina and John have now passed on, and the house was passed on to her and her son. And I did what I had done 30 years before, which was I pulled up in front of the house, and I slept that night in my station wagon. And at dawn the next morning, I woke up with a start. And just as the light was coming on to arrive in the dance grounds, there was a great ladder coming out of Kiva. And they ask you to please not take pictures there. And so I never have. But I was so disappointed that 30 years later, and I had come back to Hopi, and that the elders never came, and there was no wisdom that came of my name there. And so I thought, well, I will probably, I have no reason to ever return again. I just want to take a couple of pictures of this sunrise and the tops of the building and the ladder. So I took out my little camera, and I'm standing there, kind of shielding it behind the open door of the car. And just as I'm about to take a picture, I hear the shuffling, and I look, and they're coming down the road between the houses is a group of elders, and one man was a little bit younger, but these were old, old men. And they didn't seem to notice me, and they kind of shuffled past me, and they gathered in a semicircle on the dance grounds on the roof of the Kiva. And then there was the oldest man facing them, with a younger man kind of supporting him at his elbow. And he began talking, and I just didn't move. I dropped the camera and just stayed right where I was. And he said, that you have been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go and tell them it is the hour, and there are things to be considered. And then I realized, telling the people this is the 11th hour, well, that's me. I had called the workshops I'd done for many years, 20 years, 11th hour tools for spiritual warriors in a hurry, and now he was saying I couldn't call it that anymore. And I realized, though he was not looking at me, he was looking at the other elders in a semicircle, but I could hear him clearly, and he didn't look at me during this time, and that's when he said, this is the hour, and there are things to be considered. Now, I'm going to do the 10 as I heard them, and then I would like to go over them. Maybe we could discuss each one in its multiple meanings. But the very basic words were this. Where do you live? What are you doing? Are you in right relation? What are your relationships? Where is your water? Know your garden. It is time to speak your truth. Create your communities. Be good to each other. Do not look outside yourself for the leader. And then he brought his hands together in a great, like, clap. And he said, and this could be a good time.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Then as they were leaving, then they started, you know, I kind of waited holding my breath and thinking that then he was going to turn to me, because at that point I felt sure he had meant them for me, those words. But they just started to shuffle now on the other side of the road, going on the other side of the Lanxess house. And I realized that this was my moment. These were the elders, and I needed to ask them a question about all this flack I was getting along with all the other teachers. And so I kind of walked very fast, and they didn't even stop, and I was walking alongside of the elder who was doing the speaking, and I said, and they didn't look familiar. I mostly just knew Dan Kachanga, Thomas and Fabina Banyakia, David Norman Anier, and did I name everybody? Yeah. And that's pretty much who I knew. So these elders, and I think they're all, those people are all past now, and these elders were every bit as old as the others seemed to be, but I said, oh, please excuse me, and he kept on walking slowly. I said, I sort of started to just blither out, talking as fast as I could, because they weren't pausing, and I said something about, you know, there's some, an organization and some folks out there that are trying to stop Native people from sharing the knowledge in this world that's having so much trouble. And I said, do you remember, and I said my name, but before I received my Indian name, I had another name, and I said my name, and I said, do you remember when I was here before, or something like that. Anyway, he surprised me by saying, do you remember when you were here before? And I was stunned that he would remember, because I don't remember meeting him, but he said, do you remember when you were here before?
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Everybody, Marie's going to stay. You keep it here, because up next, she's going to set the record straight about a long-standing rumor. Don't miss
it.
We're back with the very blonde Marie Osmond.
Hello.
And during the commercial, we were talking, and Marie was letting me know, I did not realize that she is one of the co-founders of the Children's Miracle Network, which it's been about 30 years since it's been in existence, and raised billions of dollars for all the proceeds.
Well, this year we'll reach $5 billion for children. And the best part, it's really fun, is that 100% of it has gone to the children.
Good
so,
for you.
Yeah, it's really cool, very unique, nothing like it. It's the number one charity out there for kids of its kind.
And she was saying